You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Second Act. Smash, the short-lived 2012 TV series, developed a dedicated cult following. Now Steven Spielberg and company have resurrected it for Broadway. Michael Rydell tells the backstory of the original show and the new production, revealing the mad rhapsodies of making a musical. Opening photo, double platinum. In NBC's original Smash, Catherine McPhee and Megan Hilty compete to play Marilyn Monroe. And next photos, play on. From TV's Smash, McPhee and Jack Davenport, Angelica Houston, Daniel Sunyata, Jennifer Hudson, Deborah Messing, and other cast members. McPhee and Philip Spaeth reach for the rafters. Nick Jonas harmonizes with Hilty. In May 2022, theater writers Bob Martin and Rick Elise organized an informal reading of their stage adaptation of the television series Smash. More than a decade before, Smash had debuted on NBC in a prime slot. February 6, 2012, the night after the Super Bowl. The show was a handsomely produced comedy drama about the making of a Broadway musical based on the life of Marilyn Monroe. It had original songs by Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman, who wrote the musical Hairspray, and lavish production numbers staged by Joshua Bergassi, who would go on to win an Emmy for his work on Smash. Initial reviews were terrific, and all of Broadway was thrilled that their crazy profession, always a bit of a backwater in the entertainment industry, had inspired a network TV show. It was insanely ambitious and profoundly original, Jack Davenport, one of the show's stars, recalled, and for people who love musical theater, it blew their socks off. But as Smash wore on, behind-the-scenes squabbles, jarring shifts in tone, and a thicket of subplots took their toll. The show petered out, sadly, after just two seasons. And yet, cancellation did not kill the idea of Smash. It lived on, largely on the strength of the songs, which include the soaring anthem, Let Me Be Your Star, and a 2013 DVD release. The series is currently streaming on Peacock. A 2015 Broadway concert version featuring original cast members Catherine McPhee and Megan Hilty was a sellout. Audience members came dressed as Marilyn Monroe. The cult of Smash was slowly taking hold. The producers considered turning it into a Broadway musical, but couldn't figure out how to crack it. How do you telescope a sprawling weekly series into a two-hour stage musical? And the subject of that musical, the tragic life of Marilyn Monroe, is hardly the stuff of musical comedy. Would the leading lady's 11 o'clock number be a drug overdose? Not exactly the way to send audiences home humming tunes and tapping toes. Besides, there had already been a Broadway musical about Monroe. It was called Marilyn, an American Fable, and it ran a scant 17 performances in 1983. The highlight, well, that may not be quite the word, was a number in which Monroe took a bubble bath while chorus boys dressed in pink plumber's outfits cavorted around the tub. The writers, there were 10, came up with a unique ending. Monroe did not die. She reconciled with Joe DiMaggio and walked into the sunset with Norma Jean, her younger self. The musical, critic Frank Rich wrote in the New York Times, was incoherent to the point of being loony. Smash, as a stage show, didn't get much traction. and then Martin, who wrote and starred in The Drowsy Chaperone, and Elise, one of the creators of Jersey Boys, hit on an idea. Why not turn Smash into a backstage musical farce about putting on a Broadway show about Marilyn Monroe? Aside from the premise, the plot has very little to do with the television series, and many of the characters are redefined. Martin and Elise wrote quickly and were pleased with their first draft. But lines that might seem funny over a martini at Joe Allen, the Theater District restaurant where they concocted much of the show, needed to be tested by actors in a rehearsal room. And so, Martin and Elise assembled a group of friends, including Krista Rodriguez, who had appeared in the second season of Smash. Christine Nielsen, she raises broad comic acting to the level of high art, New York Times critic Charles Isherwood once wrote, and Brooks Ashmanskas, a veteran Broadway musical theater performer with first-rate comedy chops. The reading had no director. It was just the actors, a piano, and a musical ensemble. "We were a little group of players," said Elise. "They rehearsed a few days and then brought in the heavyweights. Robert Greenblatt, the former chairman of NBC Entertainment, who had greenlit Smash, and Neil Marin, one of the series' executive producers." Marin had also produced the movie versions of Chicago and Hairspray. The third heavyweight from the television show, Steven Spielberg, no credits needed here, was unable to attend. The actors read and sang through the script in the morning in preparation for an afternoon presentation for Greenblatt and Marin. As they were about to break for lunch, Martin and Elise heard from Greenblatt. "Well," he said, "it looks like Steven is going to be able to come to hear it." "We weren't sure if this was a tactic," Elise said, thinking Greenblatt was trying to raise the stakes. But it was true. Spielberg was on his way. They told the cast, "Okay, this afternoon it's going to be Bob and Neil and Steven Spielberg." The cast sat up straight. They made sure they didn't overeat for lunch, and they were fixing their makeup, Elise said. As the actors settled around the table and opened their scripts, Spielberg, with no entourage, walked into the rehearsal room wearing his little COVID mask, Elise recalled. He took a seat, and the reading began. "But it was no longer a reading. It was a performance," Rodriguez said. "We did what show folk do. We pulled up." Martin and Elise, trying to play it cool, stole the occasional glance to see how Spielberg was reacting. So, too, did the cast. What they saw was a man laughing behind his COVID mask. When the reading was over, Spielberg pulled down his mask and said, "Oh, it's the bandwagon." The classic 1953 Fred Astaire movie about a Broadway show in trouble while in tryouts out of town, but salvaged in the nick of time. With the Spielberg seal of approval, Smash, which Martin and Elise are calling a comedy about making a musical, is now headed to Broadway, where it will open April 10th at the Imperial Theater. As second acts go, this is one to watch. There isn't a Broadway performer who doesn't know all the songs in the bandwagon by heart. "By Myself," "Dancing in the Dark," "You and the Night and the Music." That's entertainment. Spielberg does, too. It's one of his favorite movies. In fact, when he, David Geffen, and Jeffrey Katzenberg were creating a movie studio in 1994, Spielberg wanted to call it The Bandwagon. "But I couldn't get my two partners to agree," he told me. They decided on DreamWorks instead. Spielberg has loved movie musicals since he was a kid. His favorites are those, he said, that have fire in the choreography. Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, Royal Wedding, and his top choice, Singin' in the Rain. He reveres director Vincente Minnelli. The way he used the camera in An American in Paris is the purest example I have seen of shooting dance. He unleashed his lens and allowed the camera to travel everywhere with the dancers. Spielberg did not get around to directing a movie musical until he tackled West Side Story in 2021, but there are nods to his love of musicals in previous films, most notably Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. It opens with his future wife, Kate Capshaw, playing a nightclub performer in Shanghai, singing Cole Porter's Anything Goes in a lavish number that could have been directed by Busby Berkeley. Spielberg's love of movie musicals was the inspiration for Smash. Around 2009 or so, Greenblatt got a call out of the blue from Spielberg, who said, "I've always wanted to do a television series about the making of a Broadway musical. I'd love to talk to you about that." Greenblatt was thrilled. As a kid in Rockford, Illinois, he was a rehearsal pianist in high school and a stage manager at the local community theater. One of his childhood friends was Joe Mantello, who would go on to direct Wicked on Broadway. Greenblatt wanted to be in the theater, but drifted to Hollywood and became a successful television executive. "But I kept trying to figure out how to get musicals into the work I'm doing," he said. Greenblatt brought in Maron and Craig Zaden, who died in 2018, as executive producers. Both had years of experience in the New York theater before they decamped to Hollywood. In the 1970s, they produced a celebrated cabaret series at the Ballroom in Soho, featuring Broadway's reigning composers and lyricist, Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, who had just written Evita, were among them. Lloyd Webber was working on a show that would become Cats, and Maron and Zaden, hoping to produce it, introduced Lloyd Webber to Joe Papp, the head of the public theater. "The composer played his score for Papp. He fell asleep while listening to it," Maron recalled. According to Maron, Spielberg's initial concept was to do an original television musical every season and then produce it on Broadway. Since it takes, on average, about 8 years to produce one musical, the plan was somewhat unrealistic but very ambitious, Maron said. One thing Spielberg insisted on, however, all the songs had to be original to the series. No interpolations of classic show tunes or pop songs, as there were in Glee, the Fox show popular at the time about high school Glee Club kids. "Let's really be ambitious and try to create as much new music and lyrics as we can," Spielberg told Greenblatt. Greenblatt and Maron immediately thought of Shaman and Whitman, two of the fastest and funniest songwriters in the business, and they had something in common with Spielberg. They, too, loved The Bandwagon. "I always had a dream that I would do a one-man show about Oscar Levant," Shaman said, referring to the curmudgeonly actor, author, real-life composer, and one of the stars of the movie. "Instead, I just grew up to be him." Shaman admits to being a pessimist, prone to Levantine moodiness. "Whitman can be as bubbly as a glass of champagne. I'm Nanette Fabre," he said, referring to another Bandwagon cast member. Sitting in Spielberg's offices at Amblin Entertainment on the back lot of Universal Studios one afternoon, Shaman and Whitman began throwing out ideas for the television show. Their template was, of course, The Bandwagon. The drama, the laughter, the tears, just like pearls, to quote the Smash number, "Let Me Be Your Star," involved in making a Broadway musical. Whitman came up with the idea of a fictional musical about Monroe, which he called Bombshell. Next photos, Dancing with the Stars, and Angelic Hilty, theater critic Michael Rydell and Liza Minnelli. McPhee channels Monroe. Christian Borle keys into Messing. "Everybody pretty much knows the Marilyn Monroe story," Shaman said. Whitman explained, "We wouldn't have to fill in the blanks. It was the only meeting I'd ever been in where everyone said, 'That's our Hitler,'" quoting the classic line Mel Brooks wrote for the producers. According to Greenblatt, Spielberg wanted Aaron Sorkin to write the script, but Sorkin had about 8 million projects in the hopper, so the producers turned to Teresa Rabeck, a talented and prolific playwright whose Omnium Gatherum was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2004. She also wrote for Law and Order, Criminal Intent, and NYPD Blue. She navigated both television and theater, Marin said. It was a good idea to bring her on. Rebeck took Whitman's idea of making a musical about Monroe and surrounded it with memorable theater types. A songwriting team, loosely modeled on the fabled Betty Comden and Adolph Green. Two young, hungry actors vying for the part of Marilyn. A handsome, if slightly sleazy, British director. And a tough-as-nails female producer, inspired in part by the legendary Elizabeth I. McCann. In the 1990s, when she was co-producing the flop musical Nick and Nora, based on the wisecracking couple from the Thin Man films, McCann invited the critics to her house for Thanksgiving. "It will be the only turkey I intend to be serving this year," she wrote in a letter to Variety. Rebeck also sprinkled in references to real-life Broadway personalities, including yours truly. "I was the theater columnist for the New York Post at the time, and not always the most popular person in Schubert Alley." In the pilot script, one of the characters referred to me as a Napoleonic little Nazi. A source slipped me the script, and I printed excerpts in my column. Rebeck called me up. "Oh, my God, do you hate me for calling you a Nazi?" "Not at all," I said. "I'm flattered to be mentioned. Besides, I've been called worse." "What?" "Fair, balanced, accurate." Rebeck then asked if I'd appear as myself on the TV show. "Well," I said, "there might be a slight problem. I'd gone after the musical 9 to 5 in one of my columns. That show's producer was none other than Bob Greenblatt. And I'd printed some dishy backstage gossip about the revival of Promises, Promises, whose co-producers were Craig Zaden and Neil Marin. I don't think they'll be too happy to see me on the set," I told Rebeck. "Don't worry about it. It's my show," she fired back. "Okay," I thought, and started working on my Emmy speech. A few weeks later, I ran into Bernie Tilsey, the casting director of Smash, at a Broadway opening. "I just read your sides," he said. "They're great." Sides are what we network television stars call scenes. But when I got home around 2 a.m, there was an email from Tilsey. "Sorry to say the table read went long today, so we've had to cut your scene. We look forward to working with you in the future." A little chilly, I must say, but I smiled. I knew I could make mischief. I called Rebeck the next morning to get the lowdown. "They really hate you," she said, "but I'm working on it." "I'll work on it too," I replied. As it happened, I was due to appear that week on Don Imus's hugely influential radio show. I leaked the news of my dismissal from Smash to Page Six, knowing Imus would see it. And sure enough, the first thing he said to me on air was, "What's this I read about you being cut from this Smash thing?" "Well, Don," I said, "I think some of the producers of the show are mad at me about some negative columns I wrote about their Broadway shows. But there are no hard feelings, and if they ever come back to Broadway," and here I paused for a dramatic effect, "I will welcome them with open arms." There was a malicious glint in Imus's eyes. He knew what I was up to. "Here's the thing, Rydell," he said. "If you're on Smash and associated with us, we look like winners. But if you're cut from Smash, you make us look like losers." And then he called for a boycott of Smash. When I got home, and I swear on Shakespeare's first folio that this is true, I had an email from Tilsey. "Happy to say your scene has been reinstated," he wrote, this time warmly. When I arrived on the set, Marin and Zaden were there. They couldn't have been nicer. We laughed about it all, exchanged some showbiz gossip, and got on with the job. I met with cast member Angelica Houston, Oscar winner and Hollywood royalty, and as we went over the scene, I rewrote it a little bit to give myself some extra lines. I mentioned that to Marin for this article. He laughed and said, "We had final cuts, so we knew we could drop your lines." Touché. Next photos, Broadway bound, Jake Trammell, Robin Herder, and Connor McRory in rehearsal for the new musical. Producers Bob Greenblatt, Steven Spielberg, and Neil Marin. Cast members Brooks Ashmanskas, Jacqueline B. Arnold, Herder, John Beelman, and Krista Rodriguez. NBC spared no expense on Smash. The pilot alone reportedly cost $7.5 million. Said Greenblatt, "It's Steven Spielberg. We can't make this look cheesy. We had to deliver the goods." The cast was sensational. McPhee and Hilty, both powerhouse belters, as the actors vying to play Marilyn, Will and Grace star Deborah Messing, and Broadway leading man Christian Borle as the songwriting team, the laconically handsome Davenport as the British director. It was said that mothers in Park Slope, his neighborhood back then, would time their stroller pushing to coincide with his, and Houston as the tenacious producer. NBC unveiled the pilot of Smash at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in January 2012. The screening received a standing ovation. Everybody was well lubricated at the after party, which was held at the Temple of Dendur. Elise was there, and so was I. Elise remembered, "I think I was trying to catch your attention, but you were eyeing a sarcophagus." Smash was firing on all cylinders. It was, Shaman and Whitman recalled, like working at the famous Arthur Freed unit at MGM. Named after the producer who oversaw Meet Me in St. Louis, An American in Paris, Brigadoon, and Gigi. Shaman and Whitman were writing their Broadway show Catch Me If You Can while knocking out songs for Smash. "We were churning them out quite constantly," Whitman said. "We used to have a joke, 'Oh, I've written 400 songs since lunch.'" Vergasic, the choreographer, had been plucked from obscurity out of regional theaters. He couldn't believe the resources he now had at his disposal. "It would be great," he once said, "if he could have a bunch of dancers and a set to stage a number on." "Fine," execs at NBC said. "We'll build it tonight. You'll have the set tomorrow. Hire the dancers right now. We'll get them here at 10 a.m. Well-known theater people floated through the episodes. Harvey Fierstein, hilariously soaking up all the gossip on Bombshell. Bernadette Peters, delivering a rehearsal room shaking rendition of Everything's Coming Up Roses from Gypsy. And me, popping up from behind a banquette right after a fight has broken out. "Is the Bombshell team combusting again?" I snickered. My wife recently saw that episode. "You're a terrible actor," she said. "Thank you, darling." And then there was Liza Minnelli, whose cameo called for her to walk along a restaurant bar, deliver a line or two, and then sing a song. I was at the bar, and when Minnelli got to me, she stroked my cheek and ad-libbed, "Hello, darling." Her next line, delivered to Hilty, was supposed to be, "Wait here, I'm going to powder my nose." But Minnelli was having fun ad-libbing. "Wait here," she said, "I'm going to go base to Turkey," and then she took a break. I wandered around before we went back in to finish our takes, and I didn't see her anywhere. She wasn't in her trailer. She wasn't in hair and makeup. She wasn't by the craft services table. Then I happened to be poking around one of the unused sets when a cigarette pierced the darkness, and there was Minnelli puffing away under a no-smoking sign. We both came back to the set, finished the scene, and everything turned out fine. In fact, Minnelli breaks your heart singing a love letter from the Times, a tender Shaman and Whitman ballad. Liza Minnelli, always a pro in the end. As much fun as it was to be on the set, trouble began brewing in the writer's room. Rebeck, according to reports at the time, wanted to deepen the characters by revealing more of their troubled domestic lives. Others wanted to stick to the drama of creating a Broadway musical. Rebeck, one of the few female writers to oversee a network show back then, felt ganged up on by the mostly male producers, she wrote in an essay published in Entertainment Weekly. Her detractors said she refused to collaborate, ruling like a primetime Eva Perón. At the end of the first season, she was let go. New writers were hired, and the number of executive producers listed in the credits exploded. I often thought that if I'd had just a few more lines, I too could have been an executive producer. Characters came and went. A show modeled on Rent became the rival to Bombshell. The first season of Smash was tight and true. The second, critics complained, was rudderless and forced. The second season lacked verisimilitude, Davenport said, but that's just my opinion. Or, as Shaman put it, without wanting to get into all that, there were just too many chefs. Greenblatt did all he could to protect Smash by moving it around NBC's schedule, where it might get a lift from other programs, but it just didn't have the same staying power, he said. We did it, and we did it really well. And I didn't want to do another season if we were just going to drag out a slow death. It was best to end it, but it was heartbreaking. Rebeck recently told me that she has no desire to relitigate the past. I wanted Smash to be a love letter to the theater, something that would show how special Broadway and musicals are, how deranged and fascinating and passionate theater artists can be. I'm thrilled to see how many people are still in love with the world and characters I created. That show was really important to me, and still is. About the only two theater people who didn't follow the trials and travails of Smash were Martin and Elise. I've written a lot about the process of creating theater, Martin said, but I don't enjoy watching depictions of it, to be perfectly honest with you. My partner loved it. I was neutral. I was deep into technical rehearsals for a play opening on Broadway, Elise recalled. I didn't even know what night of the week it was on. I still don't have a DVR, so if I miss it, I miss it. Martin and Elise know their way around a theater. In addition to The Drowsy Chaperone, Martin also wrote the delightful musical The Prom, as well as Slings and Arrows, a Canadian television show about a small Shakespearean festival. Elise spent nearly 20 years as a theater ad executive, designing campaigns for such shows as A Chorus Line and The Lion King before he co-wrote Jersey Boys and The Addams Family. He also wrote The Cher Show. Martin and Elise were working on another show. It wasn't going well, they said, when their agent called about Smash. They thought about their own experiences writing musicals, and one thing struck them. The show that you end up creating is not the show you intend to create, Martin said. You think you're sailing from here to there, and then the wind starts blowing, and suddenly you're sailing over there to the kitchen, Elise added, gesturing to the back of Joe Allen, where he and Martin were enjoying a beer and a martini during our interview. Without giving too much away, the premise of the stage version of Smash is that of a Broadway team trying to put on a cotton candy version of Marilyn Monroe's life, when everything goes horribly and hilariously awry. It's a rip-roaring comedy, Elise, ever the ad man, pitched. Martin, a little more subdued, said, "Well, we hope. We'll see what the reviews say. Being in the theater is the only job where you have to explain your failure to your family because it's in the paper." After the Spielberg-approved reading, Greenblatt and Maron drew up a list of potential directors. At the top was Susan Stroman, who staged the greatest backstage Broadway musical of all time, The Producers, which won 12 Tony Awards in 2001. But there was a glitch. Stroman directs and choreographs all her musicals, but Greenblatt and Maron wanted to use Spiergassi's choreography from the television show. Stroman, who has 5 Tony Awards on her shelf, agreed to a dinner with Spiergassi to make sure he's okay with me being in charge. They hit it off, And for the first time in her career, Stroman is not choreographing while also directing. But she is in charge, and Bergasi knows that for him, the bar is high. Stroman also agreed to do Smash because she loved the TV show and the way Martin and Elise adapted it for the stage. It's not unlike the producers, she said, in the sense of full-on comic eccentric characters, but they have some depth. A major change is that Ivy Lynn, a seasoned chorus girl in the television series, is now a Broadway star of a certain age. Stroman cast Robin Herder, a veteran of 10 Broadway shows, to play the part. Herder thought she'd bombed her audition, ran to a bar and drank a big martini. An hour later, her agent called. The job was hers. She downed another martini, ate a 10-ounce filet mignon and a pile of Parmesan truffle fries, and then headed to the theater for a performance of the show she was in at the time, A Beautiful Noise, a tribute to Neil Diamond. Brooke Szymanskas is playing a gay director whose sensibility is out of sync with our more politically correct times. Rodriguez is the lyricist and book writer of Bombshell. John Beelman plays her husband, the composer, who grabs a drink every time things blow up. And Nielsen is an acting guru who cast a spell over Ivy Lynn. In the winter of 2024, Stroman directed a 6-week workshop of Smash at the Kay Playhouse at Hunter College. Workshop might be an understatement. There were sets, costumes, and wigs. The workshop was so lavish, the cast called it their out-of-town tryout on the Upper East Side. The curiosity within the theater industry about Smash 2.0, as Greenblatt calls it, was intense. A friend of mine who attended the workshop said, "Usually you run away from these things, but everybody was fighting to get a ticket, and we lapped it up. There was huge affection for it. We recognized ourselves in this ridiculous life we lead." But Greenblatt and Maron didn't trust an audience of insiders. They distributed plenty of free tickets to civilians, as theater people call those unfortunate souls who don't happen to be in show business. The civilians, who filled out surveys, loved it too, except the ending, which they hated. No revelations here, but let's just say Smash took a dark turn. It was a swing, Rodriguez said with admiration, but the audience wasn't having it. There was a backlash, Herder recalled. So Martin and Elise did what theater writers do when the wind blows you in a different direction, and you don't want to end up in the kitchen at Joe Allen. They rewrote the final scene. Smash now ends on an upbeat note. But the show is not a sappy love letter to the theater. Martin and Elise have knocked around Schubert Alley too long to stoop to that. They were once up against each other for the Tony Award for Best Book. Martin for The Drowsy Chaperone, Elise for Jersey Boys. Martin won. "Sometimes he brings his Tony Award with him when we write, just to remind me," Elise said. It's that cynical sense of humor that gives Smash its edge. "People fight, people drink, people swear," Martin said. "People behave badly," Elise added. "People go off the deep end. But then, as so often happens in the theater, they pull themselves up and get on with the show." And overseeing that show is Spielberg. I'm told he's been bitten by the theater bug, and I wondered if he might ever direct a Broadway show himself. "It's been 60 years," he said, "since I stood on the boards at Arcadia High School in Phoenix, working on productions of Guys and Dolls and Arsenic and Old Lays. But I don't rule it out." scare tactics. My grandfather was jailed in McCarthy-era America. Political writers could suffer the same fate in a second Trump term. By Molly Youngfast. Opening illustration by Selena Pereira, which shows Trump and McCarthy superimposed on each other. On one of my near daily calls with my younger brother, who lives in Los Angeles, I mentioned my anxiety about November's election and just maybe having to leave the country after it's all over. I might just want to have a small apartment in Canada or Mexico or something, just in case Trump comes back into power, I said. He scoffed, albeit in a very loving and gentle way. You know, the worst case would be something like what happened to Grandpa, he said, pausing. And you know, that kind of made his career. What happened to my grandpa, Howard Fast, is that his government deemed him a radical and in 1950 threw him in jail. Howard had been a best-selling novelist whose books like Citizen Tom Paine and Freedom Road explored race, class, and revolutionary ideals. During World War II, he did his part for the U.S. Office of War Information, writing and editing Voice of America broadcast. But where Howard went astray, at least in the eyes of Senator Joseph McCarthy and his fellow Redbaiters, was that he joined the Communist Party and refused to provide records of an anti-fascist organization to the House Un-American Activities Committee. This was a time of heightened fear and paranoia. Just months after McCarthy delivered his infamous Enemies from Within speech, in which he claimed to have a list of known communists working in the State Department. And since history rhymes, later McCarthy hired as his chief counsel Roy Cohn, who would go on to mentor a young Donald Trump. Howard spent 3 months at Mill Point Federal Prison, where he began what would be his best-known work, Spartacus. He was forced to self-publish because he was blacklisted, with his epic story of a slave uprising later immortalized on screen by actor Kirk Douglas and director Stanley Kubrick. So yes, Grandpa became much more famous after being jailed. When I recently spoke to my father, Jonathan, who is also a writer, he noted that Howard's appearance before the House Un-American Activities Committee made him a household name. He was on the cover of the New York Times, said my father. A front-page Times headline from June 1950, 11 anti-fascists are sent to jail. Before that, he was famous, but after that... But it effed him up, right? I ask. I don't know, he responded. I think he found jail scary. Howard went on to write more than 80 books before dying in 2003, a year before The Apprentice would beam Cohn's Apprentice into the homes of millions of Americans, helping transform a cartoonish New York tabloid fixture into the image of a decisive business mogul and laying the groundwork for an unlikely path to the White House. Trump has made vengeance the cornerstone of his 2024 campaign. I am your justice. And for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution, he told a crowd in March 2023. I wrote for Vanity Fair at the time how dangerous Trump's behavior was, even as some pundits were writing off his chances of a comeback. He stepped up the menacing rhetoric in a Veterans Day speech. We will root out the communist, Marxist, fascist, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country, that lie and steal and cheat on elections. They'll do anything, whether legally or illegally, to destroy America and to destroy the American dream, Trump said, later adding, the threat from outside forces is far less sinister, dangerous, and grave than the threat from within. I was already sure Trump would be terrible for democracy. We watched him sic a mob on the Capitol, after all, and that he had little regard for the rule of law. The latter was made even more clear during Trump's hush money trial in New York, where he was found guilty of 34 felony counts. Not to mention Trump's continued demonizing of the media, also known as the enemy of the people, on Truth Social. But the November speech left me convinced that he would target his perceived domestic foes, with journalists among them. It's not like Trump and his allies are hiding anything. Cash Patel, a close Trump ally, expected to land a key national security role in a future administration, said in December on Steve Bannon's War Room podcast, "We will go out and find the conspirators, not just in government, but in the media. Yes, we're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you, whether it's criminally or civilly, we'll figure that out." Now, whether I, a liberal writer, podcaster, and MSNBC commentator, would make such an enemies list remains to be seen. And for the record, my second son thinks I'm being hysterical. But it's certainly not out of the range of possibilities that visible members of the media, the types regularly warning against the dangers of Trump on social media and cable news shows, would be targets of a second administration hell-bent on revenge. I remember once, when I was young, asking my grandmother Betty about her husband's time in jail. Toward the end of Howard's sentence, she said, he started gardening, a peaceful image. She also told me how people used to throw rocks at her window during this period. Betty said that no one felt like heroes when all this was going on. She was raising two young children, and everything felt out of control. My grandmother wasn't a wildly dramatic person. I knew if she was saying that, it had to have been bad. Growing up, I was aware that my grandfather and mother, the feminist writer Erica Jong, were of a strange species of political novelist. Since I believe that a person's philosophical point of view has little meaning if it is not matched by being and action, I found myself willingly wed to an endless series of unpopular causes, Howard said in a 1972 interview. Experiences which I feel enriched my writing as much as they depleted other aspects of my life. My grandfather truly believed that his political work was the best thing he ever did, and took pride in his 1,100-page FBI profile for detailing every or almost every decent act I had performed in my life. If I were to seek some testament to leave to my grandchildren, proving that I had not lived a worthless existence, but had done my best to help and nourish the poor and oppressed, I could not do better than to leave them this FBI report. In those pages, there was no crime, no breaking of the law, no report of an evil act, an un-American act, an indecent act. And I was no paragon of virtue, and I did enough that I regret. But the lousy bits and pieces of my life are nowhere in those pages. Only the decent and positive acts. Speaking at meetings for housing, for trade unionism, for better government, for libertarianism, for a free press, for the right to assemble, for higher minimum wages, for equal justice for black and white, against lynching, against the creation of an underclass, against injustice wherever injustice was found, and for peace and walking picket lines and collecting signatures. Every time I read that paragraph, my eyes well up. My grandfather did what needed to be done. He was only in jail for 3 months, but it was hard on him. He once told us he was initially kept on death row. It was also hard on his loved ones. My father tells a story about Grandpa getting out of jail and the family feeling like America might no longer be for them. As a political dissenter, Howard was denied a U.S. passport, and the family lived for a while in Mexico, where you didn't need one, before returning to New York. In 1958, the Supreme Court ruled that the right to travel is a part of the liberty of which a citizen cannot be deprived. Many people suffered more than my grandfather. People killed themselves, went hungry, and were jailed for longer stretches. My grandfather ended up writing more bestsellers and living a great literary life. But the trauma of knowing your country could turn on you never abated. I hope Trump doesn't get elected for many reasons, from reproductive rights to the future of American democracy and the planet. But if he does, I will be brave, and that will be in no small part due to my grandfather's spirit residing somewhere inside of me. And if future President Trump does target his political and media adversaries, and I am one of them, I'll hire lawyers and write pieces and speak out. Like Grandpa, I'm no hero, just someone who does what needs to be done. And a note to the listener, this article went to press before the election, but it seemed reasonable to reread it. And now, something from the gallery. With photograph by Francois Coquerel, Balenciaga Bel Air shoulder bag, and Pial Collector bag keychain. Charm School by Daisy Shaw Ellis. Intellectual subtlety is fundamental for Demna, the mononymous creative director of Balenciaga. His collections turn thought-provoking ideas into wildly popular looks. With its smooth leather, minimal hardware, and quiet branding, this Bel Air bag from the Falls collection is especially elusive, concealing a spacious interior and removable zip pouch inside. Though it was worn, relaxed, and undone on the runway, amp up the carry-all with bag charms ranging from neon tchotchkes to faux keys, cheerful thrills reimagined for upscale effect. And My Stuff, Rule of Law. Whether indulging in delicacies or archival delights, La Roche, the self-described image architect who has achieved his own celebrity, defines high style. Style file: daily uniform, Hanes sweatpants. Favorite denim, vintage Levi Strauss jeans. Best shirting, Valentino. Go-to for leather, Saint Laurent. Walking shoe, on running, eyewear, Tom Ford sunglasses. Closet treasure, my Bob Mackie archive. I've worked with Bob Mackie a bunch in the past and have collected a variety of archival pieces. I was recently featured in his documentary, Day to Night. A Rick Owens platform boot. They're so comfortable that you can wear them all day long. At Home, recent edition, my new book, How to Build a Fashion Icon, Notes on Confidence from the World's Only Image Architect, published by Abrams Image. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B stream via the World Wide Web and are available on our website. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.